At the Democratic Convention in 2008, Barack Obama described himself as the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. While we know his father returned to Africa when Barack was just three, surprisingly little is known about his mother. In A Singular Woman, former New York Times and Los Angeles Times reporter Janie Scott tells the story of Stanley Ann Dunham. The book is published by Riverhead, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Scott to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here, Leonard.
You wrote a piece about President Obama in the New York Times in 2007. Did this book evolve from that?
Yes, it did. I was – during the presidential campaign, I was asked to write a series of biographical pieces about then-Senator Obama. And in the course of that, someone sent me a photograph that showed a picture of him on a roof in Manhattan with a group of people, including his mother, when he was in his 20s and she was in her 40s. And I realized when I saw that I'd never thought about his mother. And I was very struck by the juxtaposition of these two very different and yet rather similar looking people.
There are a lot of interesting things in that photograph. One, that it was in New York. And we forget that Barack Obama and his sister both went to college uptown in Manhattan.
That's right.
He to Columbia, she to Barnard.
Mm-hmm. And he worked here for a while after college, too.
And you call Stanley Ann Dunham a singular woman. In what way?
I wanted to get across the idea of a very unusual person, but I was looking for a word that wasn't loaded in one way or another, that didn't tell you what you were supposed to think about her, that she was, you know, wonderful and a visionary, or that she was a wretch or whatever. I wanted it to be neutral and leave it up to the reader to draw their own conclusions.
But the title of the president's memoir was Dreams from My Father, although he hardly knew the man. How significant is that?
Well, I think if you look at the time that he wrote that book, he wrote it, he was asked if he would like to write it around the time that he had been elected the first black president of the Harvard Law Review. So he'd gotten a certain amount of attention for that and had having to do with his racial identity. So I think it sprang from that moment, and he was sorting out the sort of where he fit racially, and she was less a part of that story.
And she was almost left out of the memoir. Do we know what she thought about that?
From what I've been told, she, you know, she adored her son. This is a theme in my book. She believed in his extraordinary abilities from a very young age. So I'm assuming she loved that book and admired it enormously. I'm told that she didn't intervene much in the editing of it. She was given things to read, and she commented really on the characterization of other people rather than herself.
Well, she was already quite ill when that book was published. How long afterward did she die?
It came out in the summer of 95, and she died in November of 95.
How old was she?
She was 52 years old. She had developed cancer, which probably went undiagnosed for a while, partly through her own failure to get a particular test a year before she died, and also just the complexities of diagnosing things like that.
Well, she died before you had an opportunity to speak to her, but you spoke to a lot of people who knew her, and you and the president gave you an interview as well, a year and a half after he was in the White House. So had he changed his attitude about his mother? Or the bigger question was, is there a general consensus on the kind of person that she was other than a singular woman?
There is definitely no consensus. I mean, I can tell you what I learned. I did spend a couple of years working on this. I interviewed close to 200 people, including most of her living relatives, her two children, and the siblings of her aunts and uncles. And I think there's a real mix of opinion about her, just as there is about her son. These are people who inspire strong opinions among those who know. She made choices that were thoroughly unconventional for her time. She conceived a child at age 17 with an African at a time when nearly half the states in the country had laws against interracial marriage.
And her own home state, Kansas, still had a Ku Klux Klan presence.
Well put, absolutely. Although her home state, you know, this is a point I make, that she never spent much time in Kansas. That's one of the kind of jokes about the white woman from Kansas, is that it misrepresents her in so many ways. But anyhow, she, as I was saying, she went on to then move to Indonesia at a time when the country was in great political and social upheaval, took her son with her, sent him back alone at age 10, something Americans find rather baffling. Later worked as an anthropologist in small villages in Java, where Western women rarely turned up, became something of a pioneer in the field of microfinance, raised her daughter, homeschooling her till the middle of seventh grade. Over and over again, she really played by her own rules. And those kinds of decisions, people admire them and people disparage them.
Did you feel the need to address the so-called birther issue here?
You know, I didn't, but I can. I didn't to the extent that it came up in the campaign, as you probably remember, and then sort of disappeared for a while. And so while I was working on the book, I was not preoccupied by it. I certainly looked into it, and I took a look at all the evidence that was out there, the existing birth certificate, everything that had been written by organizations, nonpartisan groups like factcheck.org, and it seemed pretty clearly settled. I also, as I say, interviewed hundreds of people, not a single one of whom knew anything about time they had spent there. So it only came up really after the book was just about to come out, again, thanks to the campaign or whatever it is of Donald Trump. And by that point, I really felt it was closed case.
Donald Trump was just picking up on something that was continuing, and it took the president a long time to release his long-form birth certificate. You would have thought that one way or another, he would have convinced Hawaii to do it earlier just to put this thing to rest. And even now, there are people out there saying, well, this is just a forgery and it's been manipulated, because people do not want to believe that he is a U.S. citizen. I'm still getting email from some organizations claiming that this is proof that he isn't a U.S. citizen under the Constitution.
Isn't that just the nature of conspiracies, though, that evidence to the contrary, that contradicts the conspiracy, is taken as evidence of further proof of the conspiracy?
Now, his mother's name was Stanley. Why did she drop it in favor of Anne, her middle name?
Well, her name was actually Stanley Ann. It was a double kind of name. Her parents did call her Stanley or Stanny, and as a child, she was known as Stanley. She considered it a terrible burden. The roots of that name are sort of interesting. This classic story, which is told by the president, is that she used to joke, and perhaps his grandfather used to joke, that Stanley Dunham, her father, wanted a boy and ended up with her, and so just stuck the name on her anyway because it was his name. But I think there's some interesting evidence that perhaps it really came more from Madeline Dunham, the president's grandmother, who would have called the shots on those decisions, I'm told, and was a great fan of Betty Davis. And Betty Davis was starred in a movie that was very popular in the months before Stanley Ann was born, in which she played a character named Stanley Timberlake. Mm. And shortly after Stanley Ann's birth and naming, Madeline Dunham was heard to say, well, you know, Betty Davis played a character named Stanley.
Well, but she did drop it when it became inconvenient. I'm sure she had to explain it a lot. Why did her parents move around so much? Her mother was a banker and her father was a furniture salesman. Couldn't he just settle into a furniture store somewhere or into a furniture company?
Her mother became a banker a little bit later, so it was really about her father. And her father had a kind of restlessness. I'm not sure that he was a great furniture salesman, frankly. He changed jobs a lot. And by many people's characterizations, he was sort of always looking for the next horizon. And so they did move steadily west from one furniture job to another, and eventually to Seattle and then finally to Hawaii. Stanley Ann's mother, Madeline, became a banker in the process, because she ended up kind of by default being the breadwinner in the family.
In 1960, as you said, she was just 17. She married Barack Obama Sr., a classmate at the University of Hawaii. And was Hawaii a more tolerant environment than the contiguous states? Hawaii was not yet a state, was it?
It became a state in 1959.
So it had just become a state.
Exactly. And it was in a moment of extraordinary liftoff. Because of statehood and because of the jet age, shortening the amount of time it took to get there, it was undergoing the beginnings of an enormous economic boom, which is why Stanley Dunham saw an opportunity there. It was and is a very tolerant place. There was no real racial or ethnic majority. There were not many African Americans there at the time, but there was a whole range of other groups.
And she married twice, and both cases they were foreigners who were at the University of Hawaii. So was the university inviting people from Kenya and Indonesia and elsewhere?
That's a really interesting issue. In the year that she arrived there, 1960, was the very beginnings of something called the East-West Center, which was set up through federal funding on Hawaii. Right after statehood, the idea was that the feds would put money into this to create this exchange, sort of program institution of exchange, technical and cultural exchange between Asia and the West. And so they set up this program at Hawaii and brought in enormous numbers of Asian students. Actually, Barack Obama Sr. predated that. He was an African and had come on his own steam, I mean, through a program.
To study what?
He was studying economics. He came through a program that took kids out of Kenya to prepare for a new kind of elite when Kenyan independence was coming in.
My guest is Jani Scott, who's written A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. It is published by Riverhead. So they didn't know each other all that long before they married.
No, it seems they must have met in the first weeks of school. School began that year, September 26th, and by early November, it seems she was pregnant.
And how long after that did she learn that he already had a wife back in Kenya?
I don't know the exact timing of that. You hear different stories. She eventually, according to the president, said that she thought he was sort of separated, but that there was no legal proof of that. But her relatives say she didn't know that, and that's why the marriage blew up. I think there were other reasons as well.
Well, since he was a bigamist under U.S. law, was it necessary for them to get a legal divorce?
Well, that's an interesting question. Their divorce is registered in the state of Hawaii, so it makes me think that perhaps his marriage back in Kenya didn't count in some way.
And then he went back to Kenya? How long was he in young Barack's life?
He was not long is the answer. Young Barack was born in August of 61. By June of 62, Barack Sr. was leaving Hawaii. But already I found that Stanley Ann, or Ann as she was known then, had moved to Seattle. She left first, took her baby with her, and enrolled at the University of Washington, where many of her friends were from high school and where she presumably thought she'd be more comfortable. That didn't work out. She moved back to Hawaii and went back to the University of Hawaii, but he was gone by then.
Moved back because her parents could take care of the baby. How was she taking care of him under those circumstances? Because she was going to school with an infant. She had dropped out for a little while, but...
She had dropped out for a while. I think it was difficult. She had babysitting help. A woman I interviewed in Indonesia told me that Anne described taking him with her to classes. So I think she was sort of juggling the old single mother thing at a very early point.
And as I mentioned, she met her second husband at the University of Hawaii. He was an Indonesian graduate student named Lolo Soitoro. He had obligations to the Indonesian army after he graduated. Is that the reason that they moved to Jakarta when Barack was just 6 years old?
As a foreign student, an Indonesian student studying abroad, when the attempted coup and counter-coup occurred in September 65 in Indonesia, the foreign students were brought back. I think maybe some of them were somewhat under suspicion because they had sufficient ties to the previous government to get them there in the first place. So he was ordered back to Indonesia, and she followed.
Despite the fact that there was all that political upheaval, this is when Sukarno was ousted from power and Suharto took over, and there was a bloodbath throughout the country.
Absolutely.
Wasn't it dangerous?
It probably was. By the time Anne got there, which was 67, things had quieted down. But you're right. It's not known even now how many people died, but as many as 1 million Indonesians are thought to have been slaughtered in anti-communist sort of purges in that immediate post-coup period. It was dangerous for the people who were thought to have ties to communism. For a foreigner coming in, oddly enough, I found from other people who'd moved there in the time, it could be a very quiet and wonderful place to move to Jakarta because they weren't of interest to the government or security people.
Was this when Barack attended that madrasa that has so many of his critics riled up?
Yes. As you know, it wasn't exactly a madrasa. He went to an Indonesian school for a while, and he went to also a Catholic school for a while, to a Catholic school, and then to a school that was an Indonesian government school, therefore technically a Muslim school.
How is the marriage doing?
Not great. As I understand it, when Anne moved to Indonesia, she found Lolo quite different from the way she remembered him in Hawaii. In Hawaii, he was, you know, an Indonesian student abroad in a new culture. He was freed from his family and cultural obligations. There was no political pressure on him. He was a fun-loving, tennis-playing party animal. And he returned, and all of a sudden, he was under – there was – it was very difficult time for people in Indonesia. It was quite there was very little money around and food, and so he's under some normal pressures. And then there were political pressures. He was sent off to as part of a border survey team to survey the border of Papua New Guinea. He was back in the bosom of his large extended family, and all of a sudden he then had this Western wife with him. And I think things really fell apart during that period, and she was very unhappy.
And she, as a Western woman, might have felt resentment or because now suddenly she was being treated in a very different way than she would have in the States.
Perhaps. I think she just bridled at some of the expectations. He later went to work for an oil company. She was expected to be sort of the appendage oil company wife, hanging out at the petroleum club and chatting with the other Western wives. And she just wanted to have nothing to do with that.
But she was already – she was working herself.
Yes.
So she was developing a certain amount of independence.
Yes. She very quickly went to work teaching English in various different settings, partly because she needed to make money for the family and partly because she was trying to figure out what she was going to do with her life.
But she became pregnant with her daughter, Maya.
A little bit later, yeah. 1970, Maya was born. So she was able to work and be pregnant. But you're right, she developed a very independent life, and they had a house full of servants, which is common for people, even people with not a lot of money in Indonesia. So she didn't have a lot of the obligations that would have held her down here.
And yet she sent Barack back to Hawaii to live with his grandparents.
Yes.
It's interesting she did that with him, and she didn't do it with Maya later.
Well, what she did later with Maya – let me address the first one. She sent him back at age 10 by himself – to go to school at Punahou, where he eventually graduated from a very good prep school in Hawaii that happened to be a couple blocks from her parents' apartment. So he could live with her parents and go to this very good school. She had decided that he needed a good English language education at that point, and it wasn't available to her in Indonesia. She later joined him. So then Maya, she homeschooled up through seventh grade and didn't really put her in school until 1980-81 when she went to work for the Ford Foundation and had access to the Jakarta International School.
Although she had already returned to Hawaii, and that's where the marriage broke up.
Yes. In the meantime, she had gone – after she sent Barack back, she joined him, went to graduate school. I think things kind of frayed. Lolo stayed for much of that time in Indonesia. She returned to Indonesia, but they were living apart, and gradually they divorced.
And she kept on going to school. She sounds like the perpetual student. Did she have some career goal in mind?
Well – she wasn't going to different schools. She was pursuing an anthropology PhD. She wanted to be an anthropologist. But what happened was, as happens for many graduate students, especially those who have families, it's not easy to support yourself as a student. So she kept having to break away, and she found a somewhat lucrative way of supporting herself and her family by working in international development.
But then she got involved with anthropology. She wrote a thesis on blacksmithing, which makes real sense if I understand what you say about it in your book. How good an anthropologist was she?
I'm not really in a position to judge that, but I've encountered a lot of respect for that work. It was finally published as a book a year or two ago by Duke University Press. My understanding is it's something of a throwback in the world of anthropology. It's real nuts and bolts, ground-level ethnography, as opposed to high theory and the kind of thing that has taken over the field since then. So I think for people – I understand this from other anthropologists I asked about the work. For people who respect that kind of thing, it has real power and is likely to last.
We can't go into all the other things that she did, but she was she had a battle with the Cigna Insurance Company to have them pay for her treatments when it was discovered she had cancer, and they denied the payment?
Yeah, the issue was not her treatments. It was her disability insurance. She had coverage through her work. She was working at the time as a consultant to the Indonesian government. And she came down with this cancer, went back to Hawaii and was treated. And the health part of it was covered, the medical treatments. But her unpaid wages that she ceased to have while she was trying to recover were not paid because Cigna concluded that she had a pre-existing condition that antedated the job.
And I assume we read into this one of the reasons that the president wanted to have some that covered in health care reform.
Well, he certainly referred to it, yes.
Janie Scott's biography of Barack Obama's mother is called The Singular Woman. It is published by Riverhead. And I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. Great to be here.